I'm Brittany.
And I'm Heather.
Welcome to Okayest Moms, the podcast.
A place to be more than just mom.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Okayest Moms, the podcast. Brittany here.
And Heather. So today's guest is Kate Kennedy from the Be There in 5 podcast. She shares with us the story of her pregnancy loss and how that kind of collided with current events of the Texas abortion ban and the Dobbs decision, and how she used her platform to kind of shed some light on the grayness of abortion and how, you know, abortions aren't always wanted and the pregnancy isn't always unwanted, and how just like the complexity of it all. And we are just so thankful that she shared her story with us.
We love Kate. She is the master of nuance. If you've ever listened to her podcast, you know she goes on deep dives and there are no hot takes. It's refreshing in that we know that the world is not black and white, that there is a lot of gray area. And this is just one of her stories that is really important.
And if you are not familiar with her podcast, might I suggest there's an episode about Abercrombie and like the early 2000s and the graphic tees, which just cracked me up because I was the owner of a Midnight Cowgirl shirt for some reason. Like, why was that cool? And it just, it's very cringy and embarrassing, but also hilarious because that's who we were in our teenage years. So we love her takes on everything. And we are so happy to have her on this episode. We do want to mention that we do talk about pregnancy loss. And so if that is something sensitive to you, you may want to kind of fast forward through some parts.
All right, let's jump into the episode. We've all heard the research on how learning a second language is good for a child's cognitive development, but that can feel overwhelming for busy parents who only speak one language. Of course, we want to expose our children to everything, but knowing where to start can be a challenge. Enter our new podcast sponsor, FepiBox.
FepiBox is a monthly subscription box designed for children 3 to 6 to learn Spanish in a fun, interactive way. Fepi's philosophy is learning by immersion, exposing the kids to Spanish and English through original books, music, and play. And don't worry, parents don't have to be bilingual to help their kids learn Spanish with Fepi.
Each monthly box includes a game, song, and a new Fepi book. An exclusive video audiobook that can be used for pronunciation support and hours of entertainment, listening, and watching in 2 languages.
We've heard from so many of you that you value experience gifts over another loud, colorful toy, and FepiBox is just that. To purchase a FepiBox subscription, go to FepiBox.com, and Okayest Moms listeners can use code OKAYESTMOM20 for 20% off your first box in your subscription. That's FepiBox, FEPPY. Box.com and code OKAYESTMOM20 for 20% off your first box in your subscription.
Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're longtime Beths, but can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Kate Kennedy. I host a podcast called Be There in 5 that's very like millennial zeitgeist focused. It started out with the goal of elevating like pop culture conversations to have like long form nuanced discussions in a very hot take world, but then kind of evolved to talking about stuff that like I wanted to talk about, but E! News wasn't going to talk about, like the Parcell Scala multiverse. So expanded to like influencers and kind of internet culture. But per the topic of your episode, as my personal life evolved, I've definitely opened up a lot more about the weirdness of being in your 30s and our expectations forever feeling like a departure from our realities, and just want to connect with women about this very confusing stage of life where we're all at very different points. And so kind of sharing my like journey with child rearing and fertility has become a part of the podcast too. So, and I'm a writer and other stuff. So it's kind of my gist, but podcasting is my full-time job.
So we wanted to have you on the show in October in honor of Pregnancy Loss and Infant Loss Awareness Month. You recently had an ectopic pregnancy that you shared very publicly. What made you decide to be so vulnerable and genuine about something that most women don't even ever talk about?
You know, I think that I would say it's twofold in hindsight, but what honestly happened is that I very much didn't think about it in a good way, meaning like I was in the thick of it and going through something like really intense. And it's, I think loss is a very difficult thing to confessionally and openly even talk to the closest people in your life about, because you kind of, they care so much about you. You can be managing their emotional response to your grief. And what I was feeling and thinking was quite dark. And I have this really odd situation where, you know, outside of a therapist, where else can you speak for at length for a long time and nobody interrupt you and you just be able to be completely honest? So I was like, I'm just going to talk out how I feel on mic, because that's my life and what I'm used to. I didn't know if I was going to use it. But as I started talking, I kind of had an epiphany that like, I was not that, you know, I was what, 6 weeks along, no one would have ever known. If I hadn't, you know, I was incredibly privileged to have the job I have. If I had a normal job, I would be expected to be back in the office that day. And, I think what I was feeling and grieving and the physical pain and discomfort, I was like, you know what? There's such an invisibility to pregnancy loss. And so many companies don't have bereavement policies for miscarriages. And I ended up kind of making the episode toward the end about like kind of a call to action. Like I wanted to be an example of a woman who showed up to work, and for people to hear what it sounded like to be at work and to maybe make them think about advocating for women so they don't have to show up to work. Because I had the privilege and ease of doing so in the most, you know, easy way possible. I wasn't on my feet, you know, I don't know. It just kind of was, I realized going through it that I don't even think my friends had been on it as honest with me, because I don't think I was the right audience to have the privilege of their truth in that moment. And I don't know. I think that I saw benefit to just being transparent about kind of the darkness of that moment and solidarity in case anybody else felt the same. So yeah, it was partially for my own catharsis, partially because I have a platform and wanted, and I thought about you got like my listeners and you guys going through the same thing and how many of you don't have the flexibility I do. And I also, honestly, it is kind of a rare thing that I didn't know or understand anything about. And I had to make like really knee jerk alarming decisions in an ER with no bedside manner, no access to research. And I wanted people to like be aware that it's a thing that can happen. And I get emails probably like once a week from somebody that's like, I would not have gone to the hospital if I didn't know that that's a thing that could happen. Cause I was a person that was so scared of all this stuff. I just went in blindly and didn't, you know, research all of these nuances. So, yeah, that was a really, really long answer, but it was a very natural thing for me to do. And it was very helpful for me, in selfish ways. But, in retrospect, I like to think that what kind of propelled me was hoping that it would help somebody else out there somewhere.
I love that so much. A lot of what we do around here is like just normalizing motherhood and the imperfectness of it all. And so sharing for other people to, you know, be validated in their feelings and to commiserate even is just so important. So thank you for being on the show.
Oh yeah, of course. I think, what was I going to say? Sorry, I lost my train of thought, the reason I called it The Losses We Share, and actually I think this was maybe the bigger thing, is that, so when I was in the ER, I was like, it was a weird thing where I wanted to feel like I wasn't like alone, but I didn't feel like talking to somebody. So I just was like looking up, I was like, this is so weird, but I was like thinking of a recent like public figure, somebody I like or look up to that had a miscarriage, to make me feel like less, I don't know. I just wanted to hear somebody else talk about it. And I came across Meghan Markle's article, The Losses We Share, that she had recently written at that time. And it's like a kind of double, you know, the losses we share in it experientially, and then the losses we choose to use our voice to share. And I just thought, how odd is it that of all the things I'm looking to in this moment, and all the incredible people I have in my life that are close to me, there's just something a little weird, personal, and hard to articulate that I found solace in a random public figure story. And so that actually, I think, is why what I opened it with. I've never listened back to it, but I just remembered that. I think that's why I said, I was like, so here's your random public figure story if you ever need it.
I love that. So not long after your loss, Texas announced its abortion ban. And then not long after that, the Supreme Court ruled on the Dobbs decision, which ultimately jeopardized abortion in many states. In that time, you became a de facto women's rights activist, or maybe not, sharing what the laws would mean if someone were to experience what you experienced. Did you hesitate to speak up, or did you consider yourself an activist?
Oh, no, I didn't hesitate at all. Honestly, like, it is such a fundamental compromise of reproductive health and women and birthing people's safety that it, for me, it's like, this should have never been political. It's so deeply ethically, like a sense of humanity, like in my bones. It is something I feel so strongly about, that never needed to be politicized. It has a long history of being used as a political lightning rod. And I don't care what I'm labeled, or if people were mad, or whatever the hell would happen. It was a matter of, I have a nuanced understanding of what this could look like. And so, you know, the interference of the government in a provider and patient's decisions in an urgent situation like mine could have been life or death. And it's not so much like, you know, activating or not, rather it's a matter of life and death. And I would never not be loud about it.
Well, and I think you shed such an important light on it, because I think everyone thinks of abortion as this black and white issue. It's like, if you do it, then you're bad. And if you don't do it, then you're good. And, you know, of course, certain people think that. But the way that you were in such a gray area, and I think the way that you laid out the facts of, like, if you live in states like this, this could happen to you, whether you want that pregnancy or not. And I think the way you set it forth, I think, changed a lot of minds and brought a lot more attention to the issue. And I think just through your candor with it.
I appreciate that. I think what's hard is, it's been an interesting process, because I started putting these pieces together when I realized that, you know, I had a life-saving procedure that is, you know, medically, like when you go into an ER and you have bleeding and you're pregnant, in proper medical terminology, like in your chart, it's called a threatened abortion, because an abortion is a medical term that got kind of co-opted and weaponized into something that it does not represent in the medical field. And then my wheels kind of started turning, and I was like, okay, so right after my loss, we were having the conversations about the Texas heartbeat bill, and specifically it was the addition of deputizing private citizens to sue anybody adjacent to an abortion. And I was like, okay, so somebody sees something over my shoulder, intercepts my mail, or like comes across a medical term of an abortion. I'm a woman who just experienced a devastating loss. This person could stand to financially gain off of my sorrow and completely misunderstand and twist the term that means the same thing. And it doesn't matter if it was elective or not. So that's what kind of started. I was like, wait, that's fucked up. It's fucked up, period. But I think that, you know, when you I think, to be totally honest, even though I am unequivocally pro-choice, to have a wanted pregnancy, to see the word abortion, it feels a little jarring at first. And it kind of started this process where I'm like, why does literally nobody talk about this? It almost blows the issue wide open. Because if these same procedures and medications are used to medically intervene with the management of miscarriages or elective abortions, these laws are going to affect both of those things. And you would have to be genuinely heartless. I get that there can be murkiness with your like religion and whatever. Like, there are a lot of reasons people are anti-choice that can be hard to dismantle, even though I fundamentally disagree with them all. But I think that if you really take the time to like listen and understand what that means for the 1 in 4 pregnancies of the people you know in your life that will, and you know, result in miscarriage, and if you're comfortable putting them in greater trauma, risk for infection, sepsis, death, if you are comfortable limiting their options and making them suffer further for no reason other than the Republican Party wanting to galvanize voters, like I can't help you. Like, you are cruel. I just don't get it. And I don't usually operate in that kind of a binary. I don't like to name call. I try to nudge. It's not my vibe. I try to be empathetic, but like, I just, when I started learning about how this was also affecting people going through some of the most traumatic times in their lives, and how, and the invisibility women already experience with loss, and the oftentimes like shame and confusion and self-blame, and it can be an insurmountable or overwhelming mental health experience. And I think it's so incredibly unconscionable that anybody would not see why we shouldn't be adding additional physical trauma or pain. And then I was getting a lot of emails from listeners that were like, I had an ectopic or I needed a DNC, but I was at like a Catholic hospital, so I had to go to Planned Parenthood, and I walked past protesters. There's so many layers to it. And sorry, since I podcast, I talk for too long because I'm used to talking to myself. So just stop me. But so there was a lot there. And it's kind of an interesting thing where I almost felt crazy because like, obviously this would be out there if this was like, if I'm thinking about this right. But in the past like 2-3 weeks, Chrissy Teigen had that realization. And then it became huge dialogue. And I'm like, and it was almost helpful to be like, yeah, people really didn't know this.
I didn't even know this. As a person who had 2 children, I never really thought about implications of, you know, being at a Catholic hospital or things like that. Prior to my first born, I had a miscarriage at about 6 weeks. And I was lucky in the fact that I didn't have to have any medical intervention. And it was very like kind of brushed off by everybody, my medical professionals, my family. It was just like, you know, that happens and just keep trying. And so it was kind of a weird, so like even having kind of dabbled, I guess you could say, in that area, like I still didn't even know all of the ins and outs of it because I was, you know, quote, lucky in the fact that I didn't have to know that.
You weren't lucky. I hate that people even put that on themselves. Like, no one should be policing their right to feel like a certain way about their loss, right? Like, no one's is better or worse. It just exists on its own. Pain is pain. And I think what's hard is there are more like physical, obvious, or severe manifestations of like what happens during a loss that can make you feel like you can't really claim it. But I just don't think it should be that way. And they are so common. That's what's confusing, is like, so it's the medical thing of like the way they see it, it's just like kind of a statistical thing, and you know, you're kind of left to pick up the pieces of how you're supposed to feel about it,
right? Well, and especially when it's so early on, which most of them are, you haven't even been to your first appointment yet to like establish that you are actually,
and you're
in
like,
fact,
was
pregnant.
It real, did it,
yeah,
it, yeah.
And then, you know, everyone's like, you know, like 20%, that's just what happens, or, you know, whatever the statistic is. And it's kind of like, okay, like, how do I, you know, like, but I'm feeling this way, but everyone's telling me that, you know, it happens. And so it's hard to navigate. And then to have all of the other interventions on top of it, I'm sure complicates it to the nth degree.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know. I think that I have a lot of like hot takes anymore about the first trimester. Like, I'd be curious what you guys think, because I actually write about this in my book. But I had a situation happen where somebody was like worried they did something for me, and then they found out I lost it, and they like freaked out and didn't want me to see it, and like didn't, you know, want me to be reminded. And then like they felt bad for like sending me something too early and whatever. And I was like, no, literally the only like evidence, proof, I don't want to get upset, that I have that this was real is like that you gave me something. And like, it's the, for me, I'm like, I'm just going to, I don't care. Like, I think that I'm not, you shouldn't be embarrassed if you lose something. And I think that by telling people, you get, you can honor that it existed, and then it can coexist alongside everybody else's positive stories, everybody else's, you know, like, I think what's hard is just the invisibility of it. And in that we're like told to not tell anybody, not because it relieves us of any pain, just so we're not like embarrassed. And we didn't say anything too soon. We didn't jinx, like are we jinx truthers? Like, that's insane. You can't jinx that's not true. And I just think it's important to do what's best for you. And if what's best for you is to wait. And if you're me and you're a sensitive bird and you need support, like me experiencing something in the first 12 weeks, anybody I cared about was going to hear about it anyway, because I would have needed support through it. So however they found out, they were going to find, you know, so I don't know. I really think that you don't have to suffer in silence if you don't want to. And that for all the ways people thought they were like triggering me by bringing it up, they were actually like honoring me and allowing like my pain to exist like alongside their joy, which is sometimes important because people just won't bring something up because they don't want to upset you, but then it feels like it never happened. So anyways, I'm sorry. Should I also clarify that I'm on my second round of IVF and I'm so jacked up with hormones?
Well, we were just about to add, that's our next question, actually. So you just said
like
you're starting.
Should we like re-record this entire podcast? I feel like I'm loopy.
I'm always loopy, so you're fine.
Oh my God,
Our audience is primed for loopy. You're good.
Is your audience like very, like, do we need to get into any more nuance of Roe? Are they like pretty well versed?
They're probably good. We've gotten a lot of just stick to motherhood, don't talk about politics, and there is no separating the two. I mean, as unfortunately I think your introduction to motherhood has been almost nothing but political, so I think
it could not be if I tried. It's like,
exactly. So for people to say that we need to separate the two, it's, you literally cannot. So too bad, you're getting more of it.
I'm sure your audience is wonderful. I only ask to make sure I'm responsibly like covering, because you know there's so many different ways you can talk about something. I just want to be clear that it is not just about having choices if you have a wanted pregnancy. That's like not at all what I mean. It's
right.
It's just that argument is self-serving, but it also, to me, is a major tipping point for what helps to reframe the issue, that opens people up a bit more to considering that it's not as binary as they thought it was. So I don't highlight that to say these people deserve rights more than unwanted pregnancies, just that it's just a layer of the conversation I just didn't hear enough before. So just want to make that clear. Support your choice regardless.
So do you want to share a little bit more about how you got to IVF and kind of where you are in the process now?
Yeah. How I got to being a basket case on a Sunday at 12:30. It's kind of an unusual IVF story. Like the way my ectopic was resolved was a medication that, you know, after it's administered, you can't, it's like a folic acid antagonist and you can't try for several months after. So you kind of, and I think, you know, there's something, I don't know how I would have felt if I would have been allowed to try again. But I think for me, that was a little challenging because it was kind of traumatic. And then I had a break So naturally, I did what anyone would do, and I like threw Taylor Swift dance parties around the country and toured and had a great time. But I went on tour and I just kind of tried to heal. And then, you know, time came to try again. And I'm kind of like backslid. I'm like, I don't know. It was a lot. And then so I kind of was just scared, and we kind of tried, and, you know, nothing was happening. And in March, I like onboarded a new podcast advertiser for like at-home fertility kits with this company called Kind Body. And just as a part of like the onboarding, they offered like a business call with like one of the co-founders, and not like a medical call, but we ended up having like a really transformative conversation. And I've just had such weird experiences with OBs. I've not really found a right one that's been like helpful and like will answer questions that I ask and originate, but like I just needed a little more guidance at times. And that was a whole other thing that just like blew another issue wide open, where at every turn, the solution to understanding my own fertility was to try to get pregnant, which is a very permanent outcome. And like, on what planet should I not have be equipped with any knowledge of my AMH or FSH levels, of my follicle count? Like, the most baseline ultrasound and blood work can tell you so much about fertility that would have eased a ton of my anxiety, feeling like the only choice I had was to roll the dice for the most permanent outcome of all time. And it makes a difference in your indecision if you know you should start earlier because you have a depleting reserve. It makes a difference if this is something that's maybe not going to be a big deal for you at all, and like you have more time. Like, it comes down to choices and options. And I think that we often are in an impossible situation where our careers are climbing, our fertility is declining, and we're forced to make choices, and people act like there are not resources to guide those choices. And there are. In traditional IVF clinics, make you wait a year before you can get an appointment. So Kind Body they don't care. You can get an assessment about your own fertility and advocate for yourself and your own body, whether you're single, whether you're LGBTQ couple, whether you already have kids. Like, we're just are curious if you could freeze your eggs down the line. And I loved that policy that empowered people with information, because I did this whole podcast series pontificating about all the anxiety I felt toward making decisions based off of assumptions. And here this person was like, well, did you know you could like make decisions off like some facts? And I was like, wow. And it's kind of a confusing thing, because I know like IVF's a for-profit venture, and like, I don't know. It's like, it's a little confusing, and it's a weird thing where I even feel weird promoting something medical, but what I'm trying to promote is like peace of mind and options. And just, I want people to know whether you go there or not. I didn't even know that was a thing to look up. And so anyways, I just continue to feel so incredibly dense with the things I don't know. And in that conversation, we like went through my medical history and whatnot. And she just asked me questions that nobody else had. And one of the issues with ectopics and the way mine was resolved is that the likelihood of me having another one is like very high, like over half. Like, so the process of, so my tube wasn't removed, and it was like resolved into the tube. So it's like scar tissue that's like for a further blockage. So I'm just rolling the dice, and it was so traumatic. It's like, how to get pregnant, and like, it's already such a depressing process trying to conceive. And then it wouldn't be excitement. I would just be scared for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And then I maybe have surgery, and then rinse, repeat. And it turned into this horrendous, daunting thing. And while you can still get an ectopic from IVF, it's a lot lower incidence rate for me specifically because of my narrow tubes and whatever issue. So she was like, you know that IVF is like a way to like reduce that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, still not that interested. And then we just talked through what was holding you back. And I was writing my book, and there was a lot of things that I just was like, all I ever want is more time. And all I ever want is to feel safe. And she was like, well, so yeah, well, you're your age now and you have eggs, let's retrieve them and we'll freeze them and use them when you want. And I was like, huh? And beyond that, you know, you can do genetic testing, and you can, there's technology that can minimize the incidence of miscarriage by being able to know what genetic anomalies will simply not carry to term. And I don't know, it was like all of my fears, like experiencing loss again, another ectopic again, needing more time. It was a solution. And I just didn't think I was a candidate for it because I don't technically have like diagnosed infertility or undiagnosed infertility. I wasn't always like trying the hardest because I was so scared. And so I just like don't really know. And anyway, so yeah, we basically did, we froze embryos, which is, so if you freeze eggs or freeze embryos or do a full IVF cycle, it's all the same. But if you freeze, you just stop halfway through and then you implant later on. So first round, got two, and they say for every two embryos, it's one live birth. So if you want a couple kids, your best bet is just, you know, to see if you can get some more. And that's just the reality of the inefficiency of human reproduction. They just, you know, it was fascinating watching the numbers dwindle down from the number of eggs and then what fertilizes and then what is a blastocyst and an embryo and then what passes genetic testing. It's like, how does anybody ever make it here? It's genuinely fascinating to witness. And for women that have experienced infertility or had so much anxiety around trying to conceive, for all the ways I really was made to believe it was going to be terrifying, I actually found it quite empowering and interesting that finally I could put something procedural around something that was so out of my control. And while the joke's kind of on you because you realize science can take it so far, Mother Nature still does the same thing every time and with her percentages. But I don't know. It gave me some peace. It's not pleasant. I don't wish it upon anyone. This is not what I wanted for myself, but at the same time, I think I want to normalize it and be like, I'm fine. Like, it's honestly, the alternative was sometimes scarier. And so, yeah, I'm kind of in an unconventional situation where it's not necessarily, it's like semi-infertility, but it's more proactive, which I do think affects my attitude toward it. Because it's something that I genuinely feel is like helping me and not like a last resort.
It never ceases to amaze me how little time and energy and research goes into women's healthcare. Like all None. Of the things you're talking None. About should just be readily available to anybody who wants it. And the fact that you had to like search it out and like, it seems like all the stars aligned that you were able to find this.
Well, and that, right. And that's another reason too, why I'm kind of vocal is I don't want to consume IVF content. I don't want to consume my own IVF content. I don't want to consume anybody. It's not my jam. I don't like, you know, when people do those like photo wheels of all their needles, I'm just like, this is so dark. Yeah.
I was going to ask if you were going to do that.
No. Well, what's funny is I actually posted a video yesterday that was just kind of like a silly TikTok that because on Friday I had friends over, people were like drinking wine, we were eating, laughing. It was just like a normal friend hang, but like a nurse came at 7:30 and just injected me with three needles. And I just like sat there and we were just like, how times change, but it was like fine. It was casual. They were supportive. I had a friend in the room that was 9 months pregnant, you know, like we're all at different life phases and just coexisting. And I was like, this is what I want for like us as a womankind or for the internet. Like, I don't want to make it seem like this harrowing thing that I need to be called a warrior for. It just is my path and my path looks different. And I'm still having a glass of wine with my friends on a Friday and laughing all the same. And I'm not sitting in a dark corner. And you can respond however you want, but I think I've just chosen that what turned me off from it is I respect everyone's right to share their journey. And again, my situation is different because it's proactive. I just had never seen a story like mine where you're like wanting to do something to, you know, to have better control over a healthy outcome. And I just don't want people to think there's something sad about that, even if it's not ideal. So. I did post a needle video. So I just, you know, I'm not above it.
I love it. So can we talk about childless millennial?
Yeah.
So you talk about grappling with taking on motherhood. Mm-hmm. And as millennial mothers, the episode resonated with us. Has your expectation of motherhood changed in any way since you recorded it almost 2 years ago?
Oh yeah, majorly. I think that that episode was kind of like The Losses We Share. It was a weird thing where I have a weird opportunity to speak into an abyss. Nobody talks back to me. And it's maybe this weird dichotomy of like the most honesty you'll ever get out of me that the most possible people could be hearing, you know. It's like I said things on there I hadn't told like anybody. My husband, I was like, hey, just a heads up, like putting out, you know, our kids might hear this someday. Don't want them to think I think they're a drag. But
it's fine.
Yeah. Like, honestly, I'm like, I would think it's cool if they understood that I was a person that had reservations. And, you know, it's like, you don't know what you don't know until you're in the situation. Doesn't mean I don't want it. But yeah, my ideas have changed a lot. That was a situation where we were starting to try and I had a lot to say, and I felt there wasn't space for a woman at my point in the process to talk, because I think what happens when we all are, you know, such vastly different places is when somebody's telling you how they feel, you're not listening to it in isolation. You're measuring the distance between your coordinates. And I think it's so important to let people's experiences exist, you know, if you're able to provide that kind of support. And I just was getting dismissed as like, you're never ready. You're never really sure. It's the best thing that's ever happened to you. Well, maybe it's a sign you're not meant to be a mom, or, you know, or the kind of, I don't know, like the doomsday vibes, man. Like you'll never have sex again. It was kind of this crazy thing where I'm like, so I'm not allowed to have an opinion. And like the people in my life that I want to be able to confide in sometimes that are mothers, give no offense, like to mothers, I love you. But like, I just wanted to tell people how it feels on the receiving end where you're not really feeling any clarity. It's scaring the shit out of you. And whereas I want to be a space where you can vent, it is a little hard when you're on the fence and you do not have any concept of the joy that offsets all of those things. And the person expressing it does. Of course it's worth it. Of course you wouldn't take it back. And I know I wouldn't either. But I do think that sometimes as the token childless friend, people were telling me all the stuff that they maybe weren't comfortable telling like mom friends, because they knew I wasn't like kid friendly. So I was kind of confused. It was a cluster, but I was kind of like, listen, is it okay to say this is scary? Is it okay to say kids are something that, you know, I say that I want, but I think that what I mean is kids are something I always thought I'd have, and my desire hasn't caught up yet. And I can't quite reconcile the decline of my fertility with losing the option. And so I have to make a choice before I am ready. And all the while, there are a lot of people that feel a lot of ways about a woman not presenting that she expects to be fulfilled or to embrace motherhood with like an angelic, you know, it's just like, I don't, you know, I'm not really dying to go through a daunting, you know, 9-month medical period that is
that's fair.
You know, it's like, do you have to be like, I kind of was asking all the questions that I felt I couldn't ask. Like, do I have to be a person that like wants to and loves being pregnant? Do I have to be a person that is excited about babies? Can I be a person that like wants children and wants to be a mother? But like, I not everybody loves newborns, but like, I didn't love college, but I loved high school. I don't know. I feel like everybody's strengths tap into different phases of their life. It doesn't mean you don't love it and it's not worth it, but I just wanted to have a nuanced discussion about like, I don't know anybody who has expressed the way I feel about becoming a mom. And this is a big effing deal. And I just want to be allowed to say I'm scared, and that a lot of the things people have told me are really hard to digest without having any positive outcome to offset it. And it was a total thing where there was no resolve. It was like, there was no arc. It was just like a very stream of consciousness of how I think it's really confusing that you spend your whole life within the context of people just always telling you you'll get married and have kids, and without even factoring in that those are not two things you have to want. Those are not two things that are guaranteed because they require somebody else's involvement. And those are things that you can be fulfilled with or without. And I just wanted people out there that were confused, if there was any of you, to have a space. And it was cool because it was overwhelming how many people were like, I cannot say any of that in my friend group, but I feel less crazy because I think that there were a bunch of women like me out there who were pretty convinced we weren't meant to be mothers, but we did have it like in us somewhere. But it doesn't, you can't see anybody that looks like you or that represents how you feel. You'll convince yourself it's not for you. And I just didn't want to regret that, basing it off of an inaccurate data set of what's kind of just venting, you know? So that was a really long-winded answer.
Well, I think you are already way ahead of the curve because I was way too afraid to say any of that to anybody, let alone myself. And I was pregnant in 2014 for the first time, which was like the height of Instagram mommy. Mm-hmm.
That was like curation nation.
Yes. And it was like, I had to have all the like special bows from the small shops and like, cause that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing. Because if I'm doing all those things, and I'm not talking about the way I'm really feeling about becoming a mother for the first time, and I don't have to talk about that. And then the more I started to like drop little breadcrumbs to friends of mine, and Brittany was one of those, I was like, hey, this kind of sucks, right? And it was me too. And so that's kind of how all of this was born. It's just to try and normalize, like, there's a whole other world outside of the Instagram squares where right. Everyone's crying all day long and everyone's covered in poop and like, this sucks. And thank God they're not going to be newborns forever. And at some point, like, I will have an adult child who will not wake me up in the middle of the night and everything will be fine. Right. And that's what I'm going to love.
It gets better and it gets worse in some ways. I think that's just the nature of the beast.
So I think totally. You already have, you're going to start on like step 10, where I was at -10.
I think that for me, I'm 35, like I have been with my partner for 10 years. Like, I do think there's something about the nature of millennials kind of delayed milestones and us doing our own thing, you know, and kind of having, you know, our various economic and situational reasons for doing so. And I sometimes hypothesize if like, people didn't used to be married without kids for very long. Like, you got married and you just tried immediately. But like, it's just kind of a funny thing where we're like, well, we like our life. We're having a great time. We're rock the boat. We have tugboat and we have a great marriage. And it's like, we have a really fulfilled life that I feel very grateful for. And I don't know, part of me is like fascinated by and really empathizes with, you know, you like people like you guys that got pregnant earlier, because I think that I feel a great amount of privilege with the age I am and how much like reflection I've done that I can be a bit more at peace and navigate emotional complexities in ways 10 years ago, I was reading what Girl Lost Your Face or whatever, like, or not really, it wasn't out yet, but like, I don't know what I was doing. I was like, I was such a different person that thought the world worked in a lot more simple of a way. And I would have had a really specific experience that was completely underscored by my expectations and not at all by my like desires, reality, or like truth, that I just didn't like deconstruct till I was older. And I just think I have a lot of empathy because everyone's path is different and I just as easily could have gotten pregnant right away. And so I do think I had the benefit of like time to, I have no resolve or outcome, but like, I feel grateful to have done the soul searching to, because I think if it had happened quickly or early on for somebody like me, it would have been quite overwhelming. And, I commend you guys for figuring it out in Curation Nation.
Well, and see, I think I've been able to do a lot of that, like emotional work and like reteaching myself how to regulate and process my emotions because of my children. I don't think that I could have become more evolved without them, because I've kind of had to, like, it's, my husband was laughing at me last night because I was telling my daughter, like, I understand you're hungry, but you can't scream at people just because you're hungry. And here comes my husband around the corner, like, excuse me. And so, like, there's been a lot of moments like that where it's like, shit, that's me. Like, okay, how do I not be a hypocrite in this situation? How do I, like, reflect on the things I'm telling my child to do without? So I don't think I could have gotten there without them, which is frustrating and awful to, like, parent yourself and somebody else at the same time. But here we are.
I mean, I think that's such a, like, beautiful sentiment, though. Like, I think that at different points, we all kind of have to get better acquainted with ourselves and, you know, strip ourselves of a lot of the expectations we had for what our lives would look like by now. And whether, you know, and I think that however you get there, the important thing is, like, finding it in yourself to go a hell of a lot easier on yourself. And the pain of feeling like you have to uphold a certain standard or your life should look a certain way. And when you don't have, like, control over it or keep, shit's hard enough for, like, new moms. And I can't imagine the pressure some people feel to be a certain type of one. And you just hope that I love that that's something you're, having kids journey, like, brought, because I feel like all I ever hear is, like, the chaos of, I don't have enough time for my own thoughts.
Oh, well, I mean, that's there too, but.
but that's a, like, you know, when kids are older and more self-sufficient, like, it's not the same as having, you know, Absolutely. Two under two or whatever. So.
Yeah, no, this wasn't happening like 5 years ago. This right. is like very much. Yeah.
I think about constantly, I have literally no idea how to parent. I would have, whenever I'm, like, watching my nephews or niece, I'm like, I need to Google how to respond to that.
Oh, there's constant Googling still. Like, I don't think that ever goes away.
Yeah.
I never. Don't have, like, a concept of what kids retain at what, it, you know what I mean? I was kind of surprised how young my nephew was when he was picking up on, like, sarcasm, you know?
Well, I think it's kid dependent, because my 8-year-old definitely remembers things that I'm like, oh shit, I was hoping you wouldn't remember that. But then my 10-year-old's like, everything's over his head. So
you could do all the research you want right now, and then the kid you get is, none of that will work on that kid, right? Because each kid is so, like, I firmly believe you get like 10% of wiggle room of how to, like, mold your child. They come pre-programmed to whatever they are, and that's, like, as much influence as you have. Other than that, like, they're their own person. So
I've been writing about this so much because I think that, like, I'm a premium example of how much your environment can mold you. Like, cause I have parents that were so wonderful. Like, I, no complaints. They gave me every tool possible to walk into the world with a lot of self-esteem, yet still the dynamics of being a preteen, of being involved in the church, and you know, being insecure, of heavy orthodontic work, of male rejection. Like, I just, in excavating my life, I just see how at every turn, how easily young women's self-confidence is eroded, and it not being anything my parents could have done. And it also was not anything I wanted to tell them because I didn't have the wherewithal to understand what was happening. I missed a month of school in seventh grade for a tummy ache that I didn't know was anxiety. I realized that, like, last year. I was like, wait a second, because I didn't know what it was. And nobody was talking about mental health in 1998.
But our generation, like, we have the words to put behind that. I can so relate to that because I didn't know how to verbalize the things I was feeling. And my parents certainly weren't going to validate any of that. Like, your stomach hurts, go to school. Did you go to the bathroom? You'll be fine. Right. And so I think you can bring that to your kids, and then maybe they will have, even if they have half as much ability to verbalize that, that's already half better, 50% better, whatever, than what we did before.
Don't they say that, like, millennials have, like, helicopter parents? I don't feel like that's the case.
Millennials just get shit on all the time. I don't think
we really do.
We do. It's, you know, it. No, I don't feel like I'm a helicopter.
I feel like we have life's tough, get a helmet vibes.
Yes, I say that all the time.
The Boy Meets World. Yes. Yes.
I tell my kids that all the time.
I quote Eric Matthews to my kids all the time. I love that.
I also tell them to be cool, don't be uncool. So, you know, they're getting a wide range of
I love pop culture.
So you have that. One of the best communities on the internet. Your Be There in Five group has now, they're now the Beths. And what do you attribute to creating such a warm, friendly environment? Is it really as simple as bonding over aughts pop culture and Abercrombie t-shirts?
You know, I've thought about this because when I started touring and going to live shows, I was like, holy shit, these people are nice. And I don't think it's a testament to me. I think it's, I mean, like people, you know, bring extra granola bars to hand out to girls in the bathroom. People like bust their own tables. It's just, you know, I've been to live shows before. People are like vomiting everywhere, which is honestly, I would respect all the same, like live your truth. But it just, people are so kind and respectful and are always genuinely like ask me how I'm doing. I don't feel like some weird parasocial figure and like a spectacle. Like I feel like people are just so great. And what I actually think I realized is that the format of my podcast is goes against every industry best practice, and it's long. It's just me. It's rambly. I let myself go on tangents. I don't try to make it punchy, or I don't land planes easily. I'm trying to let myself exist as I am in my own stream of consciousness. And if anyone wants to be kept company, great. And if you don't like it, it's not for you. But the thing about a 2-hour podcast is it doesn't attract a lot of passersby. So like, to even try my podcast, you have to be a certain level of patient. And then I think to stick around, the type of person willing to give me a non-famous person, put a mic in front of herself, who has, you know, takes up that much space, like you're probably kind of a nice person willing to give me the benefit of the doubt. And I just think the format genuinely doesn't attract people that are kind of more harsh. And even if it did, that'd be fine. But like, I think that there are entertainers that are just that, they're entertainers. They have hot takes. They are more comedic. They go for the headline, the clickbait, the punchline. And I am just forever in the gray. I want to be a champion for nuance. I am not going to go for the salacious thing because if I don't feel like it's right, I just want to talk through stuff. And it's never going to make me the biggest podcaster because I don't have the quippy, you know, sound bites for, they get picked up in articles. If it takes you 15 minutes to make a point, it's not really great for, you know, quotability. But no, I honestly, I don't care. It's just, yeah, I think it's kind of a combination of the type of people that come to the podcast and it not being really about me because I don't really have that big of reach. It breeds like people with similar interests because I think it's way more of like a word of mouth or insular internet community kind of growth rather than something you like happen upon. So I don't know. It's kind of a funny thing where for all the ways I was not set up for success, I think that, the pace of growth, the type of audience and the format and sticking to my guns, even though it was glacial relative to most, it really worked out in the only context where I could conceivably tolerate being public facing. Because if people were more harsh, if I had fans like most people, I would have quit years ago. Because I'm too sensitive and I would just rather write behind, like, I don't need to be the face of it. I'll write for somebody else. I'll, you know, like I love my job so much, but I have, you know, to take care of my mental health and I'm not a be public and famous at all costs kind of gal. I'm a take care of myself first kind of gal for as long as this is still fun and adding value to my life and more importantly, yours.
Can you tell us about the book that you're writing?
Oh yeah, I'm kind of. Yeah, I'm writing a book that's coming out late next year, and it's about the female millennial zeitgeist and kind of is, it's very near almost due and it's taking up all my brain space and I'm still like kind of playing around with, I have most of it written, but I'm playing around with it structurally. And it's kind of like, you know, I think that when you say like female millennial zeitgeist, it's almost this funny intersection of our experiences moving through the world as young women, I think are really unique and specific and important to honor and are easily trivialized. Or we're told that our interests are the girlish things we do or like, or the way we emotionally respond. Like everything we do is like coded to be something, to mean something. And like, I just spent a lot of my life downplaying my interests or trying not to be dramatic or trying to be pleasant. And, you know, it's just kind of an interesting thing when you get older and you look back on your life and realize how much of it you spent trying to emulate what you already saw pre-approved by society instead of actually like creating yourself. And I feel like, you know, that experience of being a young woman and kind of what I talked about earlier with the erosion of your confidence, and you add being a millennial to that, it's kind of an interesting connotation where, you know, we grew up in an unfavorable enough time to women in real time that we didn't, at the time, we didn't know what was wrong. We were just like, nope, we must meet these impossible beauty standards because that's what we're told to do. And we are morally wrong if we cannot fulfill, you know, like now we're a lot more understanding about what was going on. But so in real time, it was hard. But in retrospect, it's weird too, because it's not, millennials, not a, something you want to wear with pride, because people associate it with being like a lazy basement dwelling, avocado toast eating, you know, person with impending financial doom. And I just, I hate that too. And I'm like, what I think, what, anyways, I'm not trying to give like a too windy of an answer. I just can't like precisely say, but these are kind of orbiting topics because I just want to be an example of like, I want people to look back on their life and experiences and assign significance to them that they didn't feel like they could at a point. I don't want us to, as millennials, think that our life and our pop culture and our zeitgeist was like uninteresting or unimportant. I think that we're like so important because of how we straddle technology, because of our, the timing of our coming of age with, you know, economic downturns, among other things. But also I just think that the experience on the inside of being a millennial is absolutely nothing like how it's painted on the outside. But like, so what is it then? So like, let me write from a place of like a female millennial experience and tell stories of the deep life lessons I learned in the most shallow of places that people told me would rot my brain, but are where I met myself, and like honor all things girlish and unserious that are actually, I think, quite serious. So that's a really long winded way of saying those are the themes I'm kind of orbiting. And I feel like I might've said too much. So Courtney, if you're listening, you know, call me, we'll edit on the back end. Okay. Did that even make any sense what I was saying?
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's not, I have to like speak in circles.
No, so I can't wait to read that. Please make sense of my life for me, because you always do. So could you please put all the things I'm thinking into words?
Well, it's the thing. It's like in its most simple form, all it is a book of essays, but that's like not, doesn't say anything. And so, but yeah, my goals are just like what you like and honor your own experiences. And they're at every turn, people work overtime to make us feel small or like we shouldn't take up space. And what if we just said, I don't care if this is of objective, profound importance. It mattered to me.
Hey, as a lifelong lover of the Housewives, I can get on this train.
I love that.
Before we let you go, can you tell us, tell our audience where they can find you and your podcast?
Yeah, at Be There in 5 on Instagram. And it's FIBE, not the number 5. And the podcast is Be There in 5. You can find it anywhere podcasts are, betherein5.com. And yeah, I'll come, you know, maybe I'll pop by on my press tour next year. You want to hear more specifics?
We would love that.
If you like what you just heard, and we hope you do, you can find more of us online at www.okayestmoms.com. We're also on all social media platforms, Pinterest, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Okayest Moms Blog. Or if you want to, you can send us an email at hey@okayestmoms.com.